When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey there, this is Matt Ligeti, your favorite comic book Yeti. Did you know that if enough people listen to this podcast, advertisers give us money? Money we can then use to, say, pay our journalists. It's wild. Totally unrelated, we make this podcast using Anchor by Spotify. If you haven't heard about Anchor by Spotify, it's the easiest way to make a podcast with everything you need. All in one place. Even Grant can do it, and he's a grandpa when it comes to technology. Love you, Grant. Let me fill you in on what some of us in the industry call reasons to believe. Anchor has tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. When hosting on Anchor, you can distribute your podcast on listening platforms like Spotify, Apple Podcast, and more. And they make it super easy. It's everything you need to make a podcast all in one place. And best of all, Anchor's totally free, which is great when you're, say, a comic book journalism website who lives on donations and boyish charm. Download the Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. And hey, I love you.
You are listening to Into the Comics Cave with your host, comic book heartthrob, Grant Stoy.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today for a second time. Greeting my buddy, because Grandpa Grant doesn't understand technology that well.
Push the red button, the red button.
He is the author of Gun, and its follow-up Slaughterball, and he's just a very kind person to... anyone who wants to talk shop, let's welcome Jack Foster.
Hello, Jack. Ooh, he's my favorite.
It's funny because he actually brought an audience sitting behind him.
I always do. It's, you know, and not just to like these, you know, to the bar, wherever, you know. Like, you know, it's a real confidence booster when you have your own in-audience following around.
Would you call that a coterie of...
Is it a coterie or an entourage?
I don't know.
So I always thought of a coterie, like, it may not be in the meaning, but I always thought, like, sex is going on somewhere.
Well, you know what? I can't see what's going on below your shoulders, so.
That's where all my best sex happens.
Well, now that that's out of the way.
What a racy podcast. I had no idea.
It's rated T for teen. Jack Foster, where did you grow up again?
The second time I grew up. So I grew up in Florida in a kind of sleepy beach town that is slightly... I went there recently. I had to... a friend of mine, their mother passed away, very sad. So I had to return home. She still lives in St. Petersburg, the city I grew up in. Oh, so I had that sort of... yeah, well, no, you know what?
More right on. I actually know what town that is. That's kind of by Tampa Bay, correct?
It is. No, it is. It's the little peninsula that sticks off, and then Tampa Bay separates it from, like, the main, you know, the mainland peninsula of Florida. And not to alienate any of your Florida listeners, because, but, you know, when you grow up in a place, you can have a very special kind of hatred and resentment for it from familiarity. Oh, yeah. And just, like, Florida was never really my jam. Although I do, I guess, like, a thing that I did learn later, I moved to Boston, where you live, mm-hmm. following you.
Closely. Your bet is made if you want to step on it.
Hey, is that Three Kids in a Trench Coat or is that Jack? I went to Boston, which is as far, like it is as far away from Florida as you can, you know, like it's snowy and there's seasons and progressive and people okay. aren't. And it wasn't, you know, like it really, like I loved Boston, but those like 6 months of winter are really, it's not the, like the cold, I'm built for cold, so that's fine. But like the darkness, just the sort of like it gets dark at 3 and like, And if you have a rainy summer, like, that's it. You get no, like, you have a year of bleakness. I was really spoiled by the beach, I think. And then that was what sort of led me to California, because I was like, okay, like, Massachusetts isn't the right fit. And I don't want to go back to Florida. But, like, I hear California has sunshine. and then I got here, and it was like, it really was love at first sight. Like, the minute I got off the plane, I was like, wait a minute. This is it. And then, like, I am a slow walker. I'm an ambler. Mm-hmm. And nothing drives people on the East Coast crazier than someone walking slowly near, around, behind, or in front of them.
Can't confirm.
It infuriates people. I like, when there's people out here, they wear flip-flops. They can't walk fast. You know what I mean? Like,
you know what? That's a really good point.
You know, everyone's a slow walker. I just, like, I felt like I was a letter sent to the wrong address. And then when I got to California, I was like, oh, this is where I'm supposed to be. And, like, true love ever since.
Did you go directly to LA, or did you live in any other places in California?
No, directly to LA. I had a friend. So literally in Boston, a good friend of mine in Boston, his sister lived in LA. And I was just sort of like, I just don't know if I can do another year here. I was like, hey, would your sister mind if I just moved, in? No. Went to visit for like a week and just got a feel for the city. And she ended up being like, she's a great host. She knew the city very well. So she was able to sort of direct me in a lot of ways. And I tell the story a lot. So I did a short story in Beyond Sunset, this anthology that came out just a few months back, which is, it's sort of like a near sci-fi story or near future story, like a different protagonist than myself, like a lady. But really, it's my story. Like, it was just like what it was like coming to Los Angeles, falling in love with the city, and just sort of like knowing in your heart of hearts, like, I belong here. Also, like, finding that you belong to a city where you cannot find an apartment to rent.
Oh, no.
Well, I mean, I think, like, you know, like every true love story, like, you know, if you meet your one true love and everything works out perfectly, that's not a very interesting story. So, like, that's, you know, true. Like, my love affair with Los Angeles, you know, there's always reasons that contrive to keep us apart or, you know, to get in the way, and then they're overcome, and you know, that love is just renewed when you finally, like, when I finally got that apartment, like, it was like the universe harmonized for a second.
You know? Yeah.
So I came out to visit for a week. I cried driving back to the airport. Like, I was just like, I know this is where I'm supposed to be. And then 6 months later, I was installed. Although it was tricky, it was hard getting an apartment that I could afford. But all that is kind of documented in that short story, Last Angeles. So if you're interested in that, check that out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really curious, you have this beautiful art color or watercolor style for your art. When did you fully embrace that? Did you, because I've seen some of your pencils and inks and it's really good, but just there's something about your watercolors that's amazing.
Well, I'm old. So, you know, I started working, you know, in pencil, in real pen, or not real, you know, genuine pencils and genuine inks in analog in the real world. And one of the things that I, you know, like, I read comics made me, like, I started drawing by tracing over comic books.
Oh, yeah.
You know, tracing Zatanna, you know, and I went to a high school art magnet school. When those started, like, those were the first crop popping up at the time. Yeah. And like, my portfolio was all comic book stuff, and then, you know, the art teachers were like, this is not you won't be doing any of this. I think I had sort of like, I didn't have a style. I was just imitating, you know, George Perez and Arthur Adams and the people that I like, but like, had gotten sort of better at sort of like penciling and then inking over that, never really good at inking, and then sort of like, you know, doing what I think you see in traditional comics. But I really loved, gosh, it's like one of those things, like, you hear like somebody, a musician, talk about like, oh, the first time I heard Bruce Springsteen, and I was like, oh no, this is how I want to make music. So like, some guy in my art, oh, I don't even remember anymore, one of the other artists, he had drawn a picture of Grendel. Remember Grendel?
Oh, the Matt Wagner Grendel.
Yeah, Matt Wagner. So he'd drawn Grendel, and he had that like purple ripped up like cloak around him, and he had watercolored it, and just the look of the purple in watercolor, and it was sort of like semi-transparent, and it was like, it was only penciled, it wasn't inked. And I just like, I saw that, and like my heart, the butter of my heart melted in the pan. I was like, I want to do that. And so as soon as I like started working with watercolor and like started like painting the, like I would ink something and I would paint it. And I really liked like what was happening, but I also, I didn't want to just be a colorist. Like I didn't want to just color my own inks. You know what I mean? Like I the more you get into watercolor, the more you see like, oh, there's like all these fantastic things that the medium does. And it is different from oils and acrylics. And like there are other effects that you can sort of get that they can't. And it's a weird, but beautiful medium. Like, I thought learn to become a watercolorist, like a, like, you know, landscapes and the things that you, I used to paint a lot of fish, paint lots of tropical fish underwater, which lots of, I mean, not hard to find if you Google watercolor, but I thought like, you know, that kind of taught me how to like, how to use the medium and how to like, you know, cause it's like a lot of balls are in the air. There's the paper, how the paper interacts. So how much water you use versus hue. And So I really consciously tried to over time become a very like a solid watercolorist, and then use the effects of what, you know, make watercolors, like make paintings, you know, like they can sometimes look like regular comic books because it's, you know, just because it's easy to do comic book art and then watercolor, but like to not just rely on that, you know, to make it like a substantial painting. And does that answer your question?
Yeah. And it seems like trying to make an amalgam of the two, like comics and watercolor, that can, the results are beautiful, but I can imagine it could be pretty frustrating at times.
I mean, early on it was, but I have to say, like, I mean, I was an unsophisticated artist. I went to that high school, but I then did not follow art as a, you know, I didn't continue studying art in a education based way. So I would see things like I around that time, like I think Dave McKean started like making, you know, his phenomenal Sandman covers. And I understood that they were painted, and I kind of understood like there was a lot going on in there, and I wanted to make stuff like that. But he was, you know, I think in some instances, I think if you go to the Black Orchid miniseries he did with Neil Gaiman, like there's a lot of washes and watercolors in that, and acrylic washed down to a very thin. So you could look at it and think, this feels watercolory. But he was also, you know, he was also using collage and photography and oil painting. And I wasn't always educated enough to know the difference between those things. And I knew I wanted to work like that, but I was also pushing watercolor to do things that it doesn't do. And this is going to be very inside watercolor.
Dude, like, bring it out.
So it's a very, like, it's a transparent medium, you know? So, like, the more of the paper that you see underneath it, and the, in particular, the way that sort of, like, layers and layers of hues applied over each other capture the light inside it in a way that makes parts of it sort of feel radiant, you know, in comparison to other parts. Mm-hmm. Whereas oils and acrylics are like opaque. So you put a layer and then you can put another layer over it, and you can put another layer over it, and you never see the underlayer. Whereas in watercolor, you're trying to see the underlayer. In fact, you want to keep as much of the actual paper. Like, you don't use white. You just let the paper be white, which is, you have to, like, it's not easy.
Yeah. You have
to work to it. You know, a lot of these effects that I was seeing in Dave McKean's work and other work, you know, like, it's very murky. And, you know, it's a lot of, like, it's built around darkness, which is easier to get with, like, layers. But very difficult to get with, like, for one thing, like, the paper, watercolor paper absorbs a lot of the pigment. So, like, once you lay down, you know, a color, it dries, you come back in 45 minutes and like the color is now like half the saturation that it was. So like, you know, frequently you have to like really like put a lot of paint on there in multiple layers over time to finally get those, like, if you want really rich, really deep colors. And that was what I was going for. I wanted things to look like they were sort of like rising up out of the murk, or like, you know, if it was an underwater scene, you can barely see like the image or whatever, and it was just murky throughout. And I think a lot of people don't do that in watercolor, and would not suggest to do it because it's not the easiest way, and not, maybe not the best medium for it. But because I wanted to sort of get those effects, and these were the tools that I had, I think it pushed me to work in watercolor in a way that it, you know, like it doesn't. And I think that is great. I think especially when you're young and you don't know what you're doing and you're trying to figure it all out, like that's when you should experiment, and that's when you should make mistakes and get things wrong. And I think, like, you know, like if you start like banging on a violin and try to make it a percussive instrument, no, it's not the thing the violin does, but that doesn't mean you don't yield something interesting, you know, by looking at it through different eyes. So to answer your question, it was frequently frustrating. And I was like, I think banging my head against the wall, trying to get it to do things that it wasn't natively good for. But I'm really glad of that now, because I think that affected my style. And I think like, I think that adds to like, I think people who look at my comic think like, well, this looks different from other comics. But I think watercolorists who look at my work think, oh, this looks different than other watercolors. And like, I'm glad for that. I'm really happy to have that sort of like, you know, like that, like, you know, it's like, you know, if you go to an extreme temperature, like you get extreme results. And I think that that's good for art. You know, it helps me get distinctive.
You mentioned McKean. Are there any other artists or creators that you feel played a big part in your development as a creator yourself?
Tell me if you feel the same way, but like, don't you think you go through like crushes? And like, you know, for like a year, like your main crush is Bill Sienkiewicz. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like a year, the next year, it's like, it's a writer. And then the next year, it's another artist. And then you like, you know, like you go through this phase where you're like, I'm mad about Paul Smith X-Men. You know, you go through another phase, yeah, where you're like, I'm mad about John Byrne pencil. You know, so like, I think like all of them, you know, like I think everyone you really respond to, they're all like, there's a little something you get from each of them. But I also like, I think I'm going to shop talk with you. I think it's really hard. Like, this will probably be a question you ask most of the people you interview. Like, you know, I think people are very guarded about their influences. Like, A, they have pat answers. I always have answers like, you know, oh, so-and-so, which is sort of like, okay, that's a gimme. But they're not the actual answer. I think people are very guarded about those things. And I think artists in particular do not like to share who they're influenced by, because it's a very like it's a weirdly personal question, and also a little, you know, it's freighted, because like this is also a person you owe a debt to, you might feel resentment towards, you know, like you have a complicated relationship with internally, whether you've ever interacted with them or not. And then I also think like, I think we're not always super plugged into who our influences are. Like, I think there are obvious ones, like if you look at Phil Jimenez and you look, you're like, well, clearly you really respected it and took in a lot from George Perez. And I think he would be like, yeah, totally. But then there are the ones that I don't think we see, you know, like in a lot of Phil Jimenez penciling, you can definitely see the George Perez influence. But when he's inking, who is influencing his inking style? Because it's a lot more in the sort of Klaus Janson school, the Dennis Cowan school, rather than George Perez. Inking is very neat. And I think the pencils are certainly neat, but Jimenez's inking seems to be of a different style, which is great. So only to say, and this is speculation. Jimenez may say like, oh, it's totally Perez all the way through, you dumb, dumb. Or not, you know, or whatever. Or I hate inking. You know? So to answer your question, I think it's a fascinating, I guess what I'm saying to you is, I think it's a fascinating question to really try and like swat away what people say first, because that's going to be a little pat. And then they like try to get into the stuff that they are not fully aware of themselves, because like influence is such a, you know, like as a writer, you have the same thing, you know, you read something, you're like, oh, I want a thing I read to read, scan the page like this does, or you have stuff that like makes you feel, you know, like, oh, if I could do that, if I could pull these tricks off or whatever. And then a kind of a B part to this question, I think, is
this is where you admit like who your actual influences is.
Absolutely not. Nice try. No, but I think like a thing I heard from an interview with the actress Jodie Foster. She was she started making films. She was a director for a bit, and she was sort of talking about movies that she likes. You know, like, oh, these are the movies I like to go see, and these are the movies that I make, and they don't have to be the same thing. Maybe that is obvious to everyone, but the minute I sort of like understood that, because like there are the comics that I love to read, there are the comics that I love. And then there are the comics that I make. And like, I always thought that like one had to match the other. And I didn't realize that they could be wildly different, you know? And I think I think people are not always consciously aware of, I find this more with writers than artists personally, although, you know, everyone else may have a different experience. But like, I think a lot of writers are trying to write the stories that they read, and sometimes maybe not the stories that they're naturally gifted at writing. I read this book by George Saunders about the writing process. I think it was called Four Ponds. And he takes a bunch of Russian novel short stories and goes through them and then sort of analyzes them after. It's like taking a writer's workshop with George Saunders. We discussed this in our chat that we're in with our good friend Dylan Gilbertson. Wink. Also a writer. Oh, excuse me, did I just drop that name? Let me just bend over and pick that up. Ooh, tuck that back in my pocket. He sort of like, he just out of the box, George Saunders, great writer, wanted to be like an Ernest Hemingway type. He wanted to write these, you know, short, clipped, slightly macho, you know, like just, you know, bereft of any extra words or adjectives, short stories. And then, you know, like, he's sort of a brilliant satirist and funny as hell. And I think the minute he started like letting himself be funny, you know, he realized, oh no, this is the kind of writer I am. I'm a Mark Twain, not a, you know, Ernest Hemingway. And like, and then of course, like, that's when his work opened up and it's totally brilliant. But I think like he had to let go of that sort of anxiety of influence and ease into just being who you are, listening to your own voice, hearing it, making it bigger, stronger, louder. And so I think like, influence is also complicated because of that thing of like, we're struggling to make the thing that we see in our head that we're supposed to be doing, but what we are actually doing isn't necessarily that.
Yeah,
you know, like, yeah, does that make sense or is that?
Well, it's fun that you talk about influence because I wanted to talk about inspiration now. Do you, when you're working, do you have anything, music playing or TV in the background or anything, or are you just silent sounds of the world?
No, silent sounds of the world, I think. I want to meet that person.
I want to meet that psychopath.
I think they're crazy. I think, you know, writing, I don't think you can listen to words. Like, I think if you're listening to, or, you know, like a story or something, and you're trying to write, like, there's, like, they're bouncing off each other. And
oh, yeah, hard to agree.
But when you're, when I'm painting or when I'm drawing, I totally can listen. So, like, I think listening to music is, some artists do, I feel like you're spending so much time drawing, it's very easy to go through your entire music catalog. Like if you played your iTunes, it's like maybe a week's worth of music. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy, like, you know, that's 1 week out of 52 that you're working. So it's very easy to get sick of your music, if, you know, like, so I like to listen to audiobooks and podcasts like this one. And I think the sweet spot is when you're sort of like, you're working on page, it's going well. And then at the same time, you're listening to something and you're sort of like, you know, like I think both halves of your brain are engaged and then just hours pass and you get a lot of work done, which is fantastic. I make playlists that I listen to, which is sort of like, oh, this is like, you know, like I told you, Slaughterball is meant to be sort of exploitation movie-ish. So I was listening to a lot of like music in that genre and then synthwave. And like, there was just like a feel that I wanted and the music matched the feel, which isn't always the case. But in this one, it was pretty solid. So there's a music that I was listening to when I was making it, but then I also make playlists, which is meant to be the soundtrack. And I don't mean like, oh, this is the music I was listening to while I made it. I mean, no, when you read the scene, this is the music.
Yeah.
And I know nobody who's reading the book is actually, you know, queuing it up and like, okay, well, I'm on page two. But I do, like, that is how I intend for it. And if I was, I wish you could actually go into Spotify and be like, start the song at 20 seconds. for these 45 seconds. Which is, in this case, just make a movie. But I like that too, because I think it was Scud, the Disposable Assassin. They
What was that, from the mid, early 90s?
90s, 96, I think. Oh, wow. Maybe 94, I might have it. But around that time. And then he would, at the end of the book, he would put, like, these are the voice talents you should be using. Like, this actor should, when you think of Scud, I think Scud was John Malkovich. And so, like, I think that stuff, like, it's Easter eggs. It's, like, bonus content for the DVD. I think it's, like, all that matters is the comic. Just read the comic. But there's other stuff that's there. I think, like, it's fun for the reader. I as a reader found that stuff fun, and I like to like participate in that tradition.
To kind of change gears right now, would it be fucked up to see a gingerbread man eating a cupcake?
Let's break it down. A pastry eating a pastry, but is, all right, two things. First of all, is the gingerbread man enchanted, like Frosty the Snowman?
You know, like, I think magic icing. That would have to be the case.
Then, like, what does he care? Like, he's not, I'm not a base cupcake anymore. I'm beyond that. So no, it's not upsetting for a gingerbread man to eat a cupcake is my answer. Yeah.
Do you think that the gingerbread man is purposefully avoiding the fact that he is consuming his own material? Like, he's putting aside his mortality because he can quite easily be devoured.
I hate to tell you this, Grant. What are we doing when we eat chicken?
I mean, chicken's good.
I think that's what the gingerbread man is saying. Like, oh, this muffin's great.
So he's viewing other pastries as like completely different species.
I think it's like, yeah, I think he's sort of like, it's cognitive dissonance. Like, if you like, I love a good cannibal story, and a cannibal story. Who does it, right? Exactly. A cannibal story is always sort of like, not always, but nearly 90% of the time, it's a like, it's a tacit rebuke of eating animals, because you're like, how could you eat this person? This person's a living, breathing, thinking thing. And you're like, what's a pig? But also delicious.
Yeah. So would it only be fucked up if he was eating a gingerbread man cookie?
I mean, I think that is, of the two stories, like the one where he only eats gingerbread man cookies, like that character is a lot more interesting. Because like he, like something's going on.
Thank you for indulging that. Now, Jack, we're at a point where I'm going to start asking you some questions we're going to ask every single person on this show.
Oh, I love these. I love these. Although I wish I had been one of the people who knew the questions in advance. You know, like, I feel like everybody who watched the first season of Inside the Actor's Studio had their answers prepared, you know, for when they got to be a guest. Whereas the first people were like, give me a second. Yes, go on. This is great. I can't wait to hear the other replies.
Yeah, this is going to get James Lipton right in your face. Number one, what is your favorite comic sound effect?
Oh, that's such a great question. My favorite. Oh, you know what? I don't know if it's a memorable. I'll say I don't know if it's my favorite, but a memorable sound effect is from Grendel. Who knew it would pop up again?
Wow.
There was this sort of like person getting just eviscerated, I think cut in a just vicious way. And the sound effect was glorch. GLORTCH. And then the blood was red, and then like limbed around the edge of it was like a bright green. And my friend, I remember saying like, that's this other fluid that comes out with blood. And like, we were just thrilled. Like, it's like, I don't know if you recall, but this was it was one of the first suggested for mature readers books I had ever seen. Like, I didn't know the comics came with that label. And I was like, what is this? And then we looked and it was like, glorch. And then the blood was like you had this green outline around it. And I was like, this is violence on a level I've never seen before.
And that's when you lost your mind.
Yeah, that is what I like. That is when I lost my mind.
What is something about the medium of sequential art that you love?
This is a hard one to answer. That's an attempt to buy more time. Like,
don't worry, we'll fix it in post.
Because there are just so many. I feel like a common comic book stance, like I think like a thing that a lot of comic book creators like to say is like, I'm here to make comics. I don't care about movies, which I think it's genuine when anybody says, I believe it when anyone says it. I think being an artist, I think the art is sort of the thing like really transforms comics. And like, anyone listening, I was like, of course.
It's like 50% of the storytelling.
Like, I think that there's one of my favorite, a page that I love. This is Kyle Baker did one of those Classics Illustrated. If any of your listeners have not checked out a lot of the Classics Illustrated, I think people dismissed because they were, I don't want to read Ivanhoe. But they got a lot of really great artists. The Bill Sienkiewicz Moby Dick is up there. One of Bill Sienkiewicz's best books, entirely painted from front to back. And fucking fantastic. And a real masterclass in how to do a book. Either way. So Kyle Baker did, I think it's Cyrano. And there's this scene where Cyrano is talking to the young man, Christian, who they're both talking about Roxanne, who Cyrano loves and Christian kind of doesn't know. But she's going to fall for Christian, the beautiful, fair-faced, handsome guy. And, you know, Cyrano commits his soul to help Christian win her. So Cyrano and Christian are talking, and through the course of the conversation, which goes, I think, six panels, three down, three down, he's sort of saying like, oh, I talked to Roxanne and she's in love. She's in love with somebody. And Cyrano thinks like, oh, it's me. And then sort of like halfway down, Christian reveals like, oh, no, it's me. and while this panel is going on, you see Cyrano and and Christian speaking. And then against a wall, you see their shadows. And when Cyrano believes that she's in love with him, like his his shadow is jumping up and hopping and ebullient and just like overjoyed. And then when he finds out it's Christian, it's like he got stabbed in the heart. And like none of this is what makes that page is that art. Of course, the words are great. It's Cyrano de Bergerac, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, you know. Which so it's a synthesis of the two. I understand, but like the magic that happens with that sort of, and you realize like, oh, I'm not reading it. I'm watching, and the watching is actually informing the way that I read. So like, the thing I love most about sequential art is I love the marriage. You know, like I love the marriage of it's not just writing. You know, it's also writing, and then you have art, and I love. You know, I love art. So it's great to see art. Like, you know, you can look at 12 paintings, you're like, oh, these are great. But like, if you look at 12 paintings and they're in a row and they tell a story, then it's this other fantastic thing.
Yeah.
Boy, what a long, boring answer.
Hope you can keep the next one a little bit shorter then. Jeez. What is something about the medium that you dislike?
Oh, you know what? That's a good question. Something about the medium that I dislike. All right, you know what? I'll be the bad guy. I'll be the bad guy on Twitter this week. I think a lot of people sort of like, it's just comic books, it's just superheroes, it's just blah blah blah, and they allow that as a way to sort of like let themselves off the hook to go further, strive harder, be better, or blah blah blah. I think there's an outside perception sometimes that like I think that comics is fought against for its entire history of like, you know, we're legitimate and legitimate things are taking place, and I think a lot of people are on the threshold of that and the vanguard of that, and they're like, we're pushing this to make this medium better, but a lot of people are like, hey, I'm just writing Green Lantern, you know. This isn't rocket science. And I think Green Lantern can be rocket science. And if you're not pushing it to be rocket science, you're not doing your job. And I don't mean this about anybody in particular, Green Lantern writers, in anything. And I think that there's a way in which, like, if you're like, you know, if you're X, Y, or Z musician, and you're like, hey, I'm really trying to do something fantastic here. Or if you're just like, ah, we're just a cover band. We don't matter. I don't think that, like, don't be the cover band. Like no matter what you're doing, try to, like try to make it, you give it the seriousness you would give anything else.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. What is your favorite curse word that's not actually a curse word?
Oh, my favorite curse word that's not actually a curse word. Let's see. Well, I guess I like fudge.
Fudge is a good one.
Because I also think like I do use it like I'm just gonna fudge this or and then every now and then I will find myself saying, oh, fudge. And then this is sort of maybe a little, I heard the term fudge packer, you know, in high school, like everyone does.
Yeah.
And just thought like, what a weird word. And it wasn't until like I think years later when I was like, oh, that's just disgusting.
That's just gross.
You guys are like, whatever. Grow up, everyone. Just grow up.
Leave it to straight white teenagers to come up with
something. No, it was the gay ones. It's always the gay ones. You know, like, that's how you don't get caught. You're like, oh, you fudgebackers.
Now, Jack, let's say there's a heaven.
No.
You just died by a flying shark attack.
Oh, exactly the way I want to go.
Yeah. You show up at the pearly gates and are greeted by Jacob Kurtzberg himself.
Oh, okay.
What do you hope he says to you?
I hope he says, they buried you with all your things, as was your express wish. I always tell people at my funeral, they buried him with his things. It's what he wanted.
I like that Jack Kirby would give, that's like, don't worry. Don't worry, sir. All of your knickknacks are in a box with you.
Well, I have this, like, I have a comic collection. I worked at a comic shop when I was a kid, when I was, like, in my teens. And I've collected comics, you know, my whole life. So I have this, I think, I have a great comic collection. Not great, like, huge or expensive or any of those things, but it's, like, it's my, you know, like, every comic I think I should have is there. And, like, you know, sometimes I think, like, what will happen when I die? What will happen to these things? Who will come in and be like, you know, like, this is a signed Mike Mignola. And I'm like, well, no one would. And I was like, well, then I just want to be buried with it. Like, A, like the Egyptians, I might want it in the next life. And B, if no one else is going to appreciate it, I'm taking it with me.
You know what? Why not? And that has been our interview. And Jack, could you please share where people can find you on the social medias?
Down a dark corridor in a dirty, fog-lit alley. You can find me. I am at the Villainist, receptionist, but villain at the Villainist on Twitter. And I am at Reckless Eyeballs on Instagram. Why not make them the same thing? Wouldn't that be easier? Oh, yeah, it would. I wish I had.
I was waiting for you to say that because I have an insight for you. Did you know that Reckless Eyeballs is on Urban Dictionary?
I do. Is it about... Well, tell me what it's about.
Reckless eyeballs. Staring at a woman walking down the street or driving in a car for a period of greater than 8 seconds. Example, you better stop staring at that hottie over there or you're going to get cited for reckless eyeballs.
That is actually a corruption. If you go back further, it is a prison term, like a CO. Like, say you're the corrections officer and you're walking by and this guy, he doesn't give you any sass. He doesn't say, like, fuck you. You know, but he's like, he's just cutting you eyes. And you're like, I don't like your attitude. And I can't say, like, he said blah, blah, blah. But I'm just going to give you a demerit for reckless eyeballs.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that fantastic? No, I know. And then I think, like, so I think the term was out there. And then, like, people started picking it up and using it for whatever.
Kids.
So that is where you can find me. Grant, this was a lot of fun. Those are great questions. I think you did this is fantastic.
Thank you very much. And we will chat again.
We will. Or will we?
This has been a Comic Book Yeti production. You can find new episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and anywhere podcasts stream. For more information on the Comic Book Yeti, please visit comicbookyeti.com. And for more of Grant, visit grantstoy.com or on Twitter @grantandstuff.